it is. It's basketball. It's not a fucking soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This is Tuesday, 10th of November. We're still in the doldrums of winter that is this NBL offseason. COVID has stretched this out to a long time. I don't know how anyone's still maintaining to listen, but I really do appreciate it. There's a fair bit of news this week, actually, with Will Weaver and alike, so a lot to listen to. But before we go into all that, find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at NBL Pocket Pod is where I'm most active. Find me on Patreon. You can find the link in the description. And, of course, if you're going to buy a book, do it from Booktopia. We get 10%, which is nice. Looking at the topics from today, I'm going to be going back on about Bill Simmons' garbage, but this time it involves Corey Homicide-Williams. Will Weaver is the big topic of conversation. I might do that second off the top. We're also going to be talking about Majuk, the Hawks, looking to rename themselves. Ben Malice's article on NBL media and media access caught my eye, so we'll talk about that. And then we've got the WNBL starting up. So I had a look at Liz Cambage's appearance in Playboy from September. It was a tough job, but somebody had to do it. But let's start at the top with Corey Homicide-Williams going snapping back at Bill Simmons, Ryan Russillo, and The Ringer for their, you know, quote-unquote garbage NBL league comments. Homicide's been called a bozo, bush league, and unprofessional. I've seen self-proclaimed basketball journalists and historians call for his removal from the broadcast. I'll say this much. At least he's got the balls to do and say something when the time is right. Evil prevails when good men do nothing. Homicide articulated it well when he said it. He said it was bully tactics. I had thought about changing the name of this podcast to the Garbage Pocket Podcast, but I think I'll stay with NBL for now. Homicide showed faith and belief in the NBL product. He put his face and his name and his reputation and his money on the line to say, no, the NBL is a good, investable product worth your time. And he gave some pushback, and I thought it was really commendable. It was the right thing to do, and he did it, and he did it in the right way. So good for him. Let's jump on to the next big topic. Will Weaver to OKC. Will Weaver is currently in quarantine in Oklahoma, getting ready to either interview or more than likely sign a contract to be the head coach of that team. Seems a bit of a stretch that he would be going for the assistant coach job, which was rumored a couple of weeks, maybe even a month ago. Seems like you wouldn't do that for someone who you just bring in as an assistant. Flying a candidate during the pandemic. Seems likely he's got the job, doesn't it? Let's not confuse things here, though. Sam Presti, general manager of the Oklahoma City Thunder, never met him. Very avant-garde GM, prone to experimentation and risk by his looking at his resume. Weaver is a risk. He's unproven, certainly at NBA level. I think he's unproven full stop, and I think he's certainly unproven at the NBA level because he's never worked at the NBA. Did I say NBA or NBL? He's unproven at the NBA level, and I think unproven as well. But Weaver would, I assume, be a cheaper hire. I doubt he'd command a huge salary, and I don't think he's a hugely hot commodity among NBA circles. I don't think a lot of teams are going, oh, quick, we've got to get this guy before someone else does. I don't think that's going on. Just me. Also, the Thunder are looking to trade Chris Paul and enter a rebuild. Coaching a rebuilding NBA team is, I'd say, not a difficult task. Simply retain positivity in the face of losing and have a narrative prepared for your development. There will be few close games, let alone any high-pressure playoff games in OKC's immediate future. So the job doesn't really require assertive, nuanced, calculated, savvy in-game decision-making from their coach. It begs the question, what are you looking for from an NBA head coach if you're a general manager? What are the most important criteria? And obviously it depends team to team, but if you look at the Thunder, I think they're looking to save a bit of cash, get someone new, get someone young, get someone who can withstand losing in the NBA. I think Weaver ticks those boxes. But for me, if I'm looking at it broad spectrum of what are the criteria for an NBA coach, I think you'd agree that the criteria would be management agreeability, interpersonal relationship skills, interview charisma, player development, injury and fatigue management, in-game strategy, and lineup rotational acumen. Now, what gives me the authority to comment on Will Weaver? Obviously, I watched a lot of his games. I've met him briefly in person at a Sydney Kings media day, and we've also had a private 20, 25-minute Zoom chat, maybe. In this minute time I've spent with Weaver, I had to ask myself, is it a help or a hindrance to evaluating him as a coach? I think the best way to tell if he's a good coach or not is to, funnily enough, watch him coach, and we can all do that. He and his team, the Sydney Kings, were on a well-lit 94 by 50-foot square space that was fully televised from multiple angles. You don't need to have spoken to him in person to know if he's a good basketball coach or not. You can see it. It's nice to give your ego a stroke by rubbing shoulders with a Will Weaver, but I don't think it actually means much to an evaluation. And looking at that, Will Weaver's performance with the Kings, Melbourne won 18 games with Casper Ware. The Kings won 20, up two wins from NBL 19. That's the Kings. The Kings' imports in NBL 19 were Jerome Randall, David Ware, and Ray Turner. What I'm getting at is it was a better roster. Casper Ware, Jayshon Tate, retaining Bogut, Cooks, Luzada, Deshaun Taylor, along with Lish, newly. Was this team on paper two wins better than its team preceding it? One would argue yes, and perhaps even then some. Weaver's greatest success, and I've written this on my article on Patreon that you're welcome to go to, Weaver got a lot out of Newley. I didn't think he had what he had going into last year. Kickett most certainly had a fantastic year, and Sean Bruce. Those three are his crowning achievements from last year. But Casper Ware's woes were an issue. They were an issue all year, and especially in the playoffs. And he's leaving that problem on the table should he take the job in OKC. I was really interested to look forward to NBL 21 and see, well, are Casper Ware's woes going to come with him into a new season? What is Weaver going to do to get the best out of his best player, which I feel is the most important thing as a coach? What can you get out of your best player? Because he's ultimately, or she's ultimately, the person and the player who's going to win you these games. Did the improvement in Newley, Kickett, and Bruce come at the expense of Casper Ware? That's a question for you. I'll say this much, and this is a silly way to put it, but the perfect dimensions of the female form are 36, 24, 36, if you believe the Commodores. In games 1, 2, and 3 of the NBL Finals last season, Weaver substituted John Candy's measurements, 46, 44, 61, for a total of 151 substitutions to Gleason's 84. That's, you know, relatively close to double. It's not double, but it's not. That is an inflated number of substitutions. It's not good, and it showed. If substituting is cool, then consider Will Weaver Miles Davis. Why did he substitute the way he did? No one ever asked that question. I was hoping to. It didn't happen. Was his great number of substitutions beneficial to their play? No. Was it to placate and conflict the void amongst players? Everyone gets their own little allotment. Everybody's fair. I felt like with that rotation, everybody got just enough to get fed, but no one felt satisfied, and it showed in games 1 and 3 in the finals that they lost, and against Melbourne in the ones they lost too. Did the Kings play a super entertaining quote-unquote brand of basketball? Not really. Drops defense, threes and free throws. For a team that wore the same colors as the Showtime Lakers, it was more like a matinee dress rehearsal at times. Effective, yes, to 28 games, 8 losses. But entertaining? My question to you. But how would I rate Weaver in the above stated categories? And I'll go through them one by one. Management agreeability, 10 out of 10. I don't think at any point he went against Chris Pongras or Paul Smith or said anything in the media that was remotely controversial. Interpersonal skills, 10 out of 10. Super charming guy. American accent. Not imposing in stature. You're quite slim and, you know, gets along well with people. Interview charisma and likability, 9 out of 10. Other than a few slip-ups in media days, I remember there was a time he kind of had, well, people perceived that he'd taken a swipe at Matt McQuaid one time. But overall, likable, funny, interesting, engaging, certainly. Player development, 7 or 8 out of 10. Got a lot of newly, as I said before, Sean Bruce and kick it. But that is offset by perhaps a little bit of a reduction in, well, quite a reduction in Casper Ware. And then Bogut. Bogut didn't have a great year. I mean, Bogut was MVP the year before and was probably due to health half the player he was. Still good enough for NBL second team over Sean Long, but that's a different conversation. Injury and fatigue management, 9 out of 10, if not 10 out of 10. The rotations were very sympathetic to players' bodies. Guys, I mean, Bogut load-managed games, which is, you know, a bit of a finger to the fans of New Zealand and the spirit of the game, but it was a great handshake for Bogut's health and that team going forward. But, you know, the way he did his rotations, bringing Tate out early within 3 minutes of a game, I'm sure it had some rationale to it that was injury and fatigue related. So that's pretty good. In-game strategy, I gave him 5 out of 10. I didn't see anything that was, I think he had read sprawl ball and seen where modern basketball was going in the Daryl Morey scheme and replicated that. Did he bring in a totally nuanced style of offense that was, whoa, look at the scores, look at this team play? I don't think he did that. And not that he has a responsibility to do that, or it's in his detriment to do that, but he didn't. It's not like they played a free-flowing style that was, you know, particularly graceful or one of a kind. And this is my last one. Lineup rotation acumen. I'm going to say 3 out of 10. Honestly, I thought his rotations were paint by numbers. You know, and people are going to be critical. You know, they won 20 games. They're a good team. They did lose. They almost lost to Melbourne. They did lose to Perth, or were going to lose that series. He's a good coach, and he's a nice guy. But and these ratings I've given, the negative ones, they're not all he'll ever be. Will Weaver is in year two of a head coaching career. Year two. Two seasons as a head coach. Yes, you can. The assistant coaching job is worth something, but it's not a head coach, and it never will be. It's not the same thing. And the amount of assistant coaches who jump to head coaches and do poorly are, well, outnumber the number of sand grains on the Sahara. So, but these are not all he'll ever be. He's 2 years into a career, and to then go from G League to NBL to NBA within 3 years is an amazing. Is an amazing jump, but I think he'll experience some growing pains. And it comes down to the question of, you know, is he worthy? Is this the right choice? Is he a better NBA candidate than a Gleason or a Beveridge or a Joey Wright or a Brian Gorgian? You know, it's an interesting little thing. Yeah, I'm sure he'll mature, but that's just how I saw it with these ratings. And if you're watching the games he coached in a vacuum, I think you'd come to the same conclusion that I have about Will Weaver as a coach. But at the end of the day, I wish him really, really well, if and when he gets it, which looks likely. Let's move on. Majuk out with a ruptured Achilles for the Perth Wildcats, gone for presumably the season, depending on if and when it starts. Sad for him. Serviceable player, but, you know, set to turn 28 in December, so this season would have coincided nicely with his maturation as a player. Let's not overstate this. It's a horrible injury and I feel bad for him, but, you know, if we were just stripping it down and being real brutal about this as far as Majuk's standing within the Perth Wildcats, 10 minutes per game, 3 rebounds, 3 points. Poor foul shooter that kept him out of close games at the end, 55% from the line. Didn't do a lot in the finals. Didn't play a lot. One game in game two, I think he played 2 minutes, played around about that average of his, about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit less. I think his departure is a bigger loss on paper than it is on the floor. It does highlight the absence of bigs. That absence of bigs is really glaring for the Wildcats right now. But I don't know if it makes a huge difference on the floor. And I hate to be cruel to Majuk, but if you're looking at it objectively, I don't see how the Wildcats could be pulling their hair out going, how are we going to get 8 to 10 minutes of decent rebounding production he didn't play any more than that in the finals, and that's just how it is. And he never quite got Gleeson's trust or faith, I found. And I think a little bit of it was unfounded. I think he could have been a 10 to 15 minute player in the NBL, but free throws, to me, were his biggest hindrance keeping him off the floor. Moving on, the Hawks looking to re-implement the Illawarra bit to their name. My answer, yeah, sure, whatever. I think this storyline is kind of weird. Andrew Canyon, friend of the program, texted me earlier in the week and said, was this a ploy the whole time by the Hawks to kind of take it away and then dangle it back like a piece of cheese in front of the Hawks fans? I don't know. Seems weird, but Illawarra, this is your chance. If you want the name back and it means as much to you as you said it did, well, become a member or whatever the conditions are. I'll be honest with you, outside of Illawarra, this is kind of like when a kid is running along a side of a swimming pool and he's like, oh, watch me go off the diving board, and you're just still reading your book going, oh, yeah, that's great, whatever. So that's my take on that. But, you know, fair play to him. I think it'd be all right to bring back the Illawarra name, keep some sort of history. Let's go on to, sticking with NBL, let's go Ben Malice. This is an article I caught online. It was, the title of the article was, would the NBL benefit from greater media access? I meant to reach out to Ben. I literally read this article straight away, typed up some notes, and have started recording. So I'll get in touch with him after and get his thoughts in retort or reply. Essentially, it's about, yeah, widening the access to the media for the NBL. And that's why it caught my eye. Malice, like Bogut, is fond of the NBA idea of having media in the locker room. I don't know if I'm so keen. I think if I had the opportunity to enter an NBL locker room, would I? I probably would. Would I feel comfortable about it? No, I think it's. I think that's a player's space. I think that's a work. You're entering onto the workspace there. I think the locker room and the court are a little bit sacred to players, coaches, and those working around the team. I don't think the media, I don't think there's anything that could be gained from going into those locker rooms. What I think you get that little bit of a bit of an ego jerk where you get to walk in and you get to go voyeuristic, you get to go behind the curtain. Ooh. But is there anything you're asking a player as they're tying up their sneakers that is really going to be that poignant? And then also, are you going to be able to get it out in time? Is it going to have relevance? I like the idea of, I mean, you always say yes to something rather than no, but I don't know about its worth immediately if it jumps at me. Also, getting a lot of Bogut in this article, a lot of Bogut quotes, and I found that a bit specious because in the article, it talks about how the big condition that separates the NBL from the NBA is the money. The reason why the NBA has an open locker room is because it's such big money and the media are such a big part of generating that money. But the article says that the NBL doesn't have that, so maybe that same condition shouldn't exist. But then to take Bogut's quotes is, again, specious, superficially plausible, but in actuality wrong, because Bogut has NBA money. He may play in the NBL and get an NBL salary now, but he's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. A quote from someone like, if you're sticking with the Sydney Kings, Sean Bruce, or if we go over to the Adelaide 36ers and a Jack McVay, someone who's young and hasn't got the NBA money and that sort of push behind them, would have been a little bit more, maybe not more relevant, but certainly would have been nice in contrast. One quote from the article reads that Malice would like to see stuff about the NBL media run deeper than the benign analysis of a game day affair. And I think I'm maybe paraphrasing that out of context there, but I think that there's enough going on the court. And if you're a good enough storyteller, I feel like there's enough there to make it interesting. And what my point is that what are we hoping for with greater access? Are we hoping for a greater understanding into the players or a greater understanding into the game? And I feel like the NBA player-centric model is kind of, we're starting to see the chips in it now and the cracks in it. And I think the more you can focus on the game, because the game is what draws people. The competition, the players, as terrible as it sounds, do come and go. The game remains. And I think to deflect attention away from that, and again, he's not saying exclusively do player-centric stuff, but you're always, with all of this, you're always looking at the game story, not the player story. That's just me anyway. Jeremy Lohliger does counter the argument that there should be more NBL Media Access with the idea that the timeouts are televised live, which is pretty unique to the NBL. It's very rare and it's exclusive, and it needs to be preserved for the broadcast to increase that broadcast's appeal. And I actually thought that was a pretty articulate answer. Here's where I think Malz makes a mistake. In the article, and I see this all the time, sorry, I'm just going to take a swig of water right now. In the article, and a lot of basketball writers make this mistake of saying that, well, look at the popularity of NBA players in the NBA. Pardon me, Australian players in the NBA. And look at the popularity of the Boomers and the Opals. And look at where basketball is trending. Look at where basketball is trending. I don't see a huge connection between Australian players in the NBA, Australian players in Europe, and the Olympic Games and the NBL specifically. I cannot make that quantum leap that people make. I don't see where Ben Simmons starring in the NBA for the Philadelphia 76ers helps the Adelaide 36ers. What I would actually argue it does the opposite. Oh, Ben Simmons, the best Australian product, has bypassed the NBL. Remember, we're talking about NBL terms here, not Australian basketball. People blur the lines. There is a huge difference between these. I don't see where Ben Simmons playing for Philadelphia 76ers helps the Adelaide 36ers, for example. He has bypassed the league. He's never played in the league. He doesn't talk about the league. I'm failing to see this quantum leap in logic. I don't understand it. And then with the Opals as well, the Olympic teams, Opals and Boomers, yes, if there's an NBL connection to the Boomers, like a Mitch Creek or a Golding, like there was at the FIBA World Cup, that makes sense. But they are more and more becoming a rarity. And once Bogut is gone, depending on what happens with this Olympic team, there may be none there, depending on who plays. So, well, Cotton will be there, actually, under any circumstance. So I've never been able to understand that logic. And my point is this. Andrew Bogut was taken number one in the, 05 draft? He played multiple years in the NBA. Never did I watch him play for the Bucks or the Warriors or the Lakers or the Cavs or the Mavericks and think, oh yeah, tonight I'm going to watch the NBL. A league at that point he'd never played in. And to that point wasn't really interacting with. The last time the NBA had a star from Australia, being Bogut, the NBL was never in a worse place. And if you need more on this, just type in Andrew Bogut and Sydney Spirit to Google, where he had to prop up the team and, in essence, the league. I don't see how Australian players playing outside the NBL helps the NBL in any real measurable way. It helps Australian basketball and the popularity of the game, but we're talking NBL here. I think, if anything, it does the opposite. I think fans think, oh, well, he's bypassed the NBL, so will I. And I think that's a mistake. Paul Smith is quoted in this article, and the Paul Smith quotes do make me chuckle for two reasons. Firstly, to know why more intimately, you'll need to join my Patreon and read a couple of my articles up on there. But in my experience, no team more so than the Sydney Kings has been more difficult to work with. There, I said it. I hope I don't get in too much trouble for that, but I can respect why they might be what I would term difficult. Maybe what I'm describing as difficult is fair play or protective. You know, I totally understand and respect all that. But from my angle, difficult. So to hear Paul Smith quoted like that did make me sort of chuckle a bit. And to give you an example, so I've been turned down from the Kings for a bunch of interviews for multiple reasons, some of which are valid. But I've had Bryce Cotton on this podcast. Perth Wildcat, MVP, you would assume one of the more coveted interviews you can get. I approached Bryce in an email. I said, hey, let's have the chats. He said, sure, just run it by the PR people at the Wildcats. Part of me was like, oh no, I've done this dance before. Got in touch with the PR at the Wildcats, and their reply in an email was almost, it was comical, because they went, yeah, I thought you'd work this out with Bryce himself. Whatever, you and Bryce work it out. And it was so refreshing that I thought, oh, that's great. And that's the Wildcats. So thank you to them for allowing it. But just being so sort of like, yeah, just work it out. It's not my, it would not be my traditional, the way things have traditionally gone. Secondly, what made me chuckle is Smith's comments in this article are from August. We are now in November. They're 3 to 4 months old. So my question would be, does Paul Smith feel the same way now? Were those comments given to questions pertaining to this article and this topic? And they're going to Bogut, even if Bogut's comments, are written as earlier this year. That's a quote. My question, how early does he feel the same way? Would either of them practice what they preach and give Malice the time to ask these questions now? I don't get it. You know, how long did this thing take to write? So both are calling, both Bogut and Smith are calling for greater media attention and access. Why are their quotes from months ago? As I said, how long did this take to write? And if they're so free about giving interviews, why are the quotes, were they not asked? Did they turn them down? I don't know. Milk only lasts 4 to 7 days in the fridge once open. It's my experience that opinions go bad a lot quicker than that. Malice ends the article by saying, quote, in the absence of financial evidence that a changing model will improve the position of those stakeholders, namely the NBL, changing a model that doesn't demand NBA-level access appears a step too far. Translation, there's no evidence that greater media would increase cash, so don't bother at this stage. It sort of underwrote the whole article. I found it a strange inclusion at the end. But, you know, what made me, and I'm thankful to Malice for making me ever think about this, but I don't think the NBA player-centric model works in Australia. There does seem to be an eye and an appetite towards teamwork in the Australian sports fan. I think that more so than the United States, can't comment for Europe. And for that reason, I disagree with Bogut, who in the article said that, you know, I think the NBL should mimic the NBA business model. Now, to what degree, I don't know, but on the broad spectrum of that statement, I would disagree. To mimic the business model of a country with a different culture, history, food, demographics, and pay scale, to take an American product in Australia and think you can pick one up and plant it over, is not ideal. Now, Bogut does go on to say that they should mimic it to a degree, but I would say, I would say that the NBA model is not irrelevant, but borderline. I think a move away from the current state, which is a Buzz Aldrin from The Simpsons marketing idea of it's the second best league in the world and second comes right after first, I don't like that. I think a better tagline is the best basketball league in the country. And if you want to be more broadly, the best basketball in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, I'm not too familiar with South American leagues, so I hope that's true, but I think that's accurate in saying it's the best basketball in the Southern Hemisphere. I think that rolls better than it's the second best league in the world. I don't think Pepsi would ever come out and say, like, listen, it's the second best black water in the world. I'm not appetized. And I go back to a thing of the NBL is basketball you can see and touch and be a part of. Don't discredit the NBA. Of course not. It's the best league in the world. But say to people, enjoy your NBA basketball over breakfast. If you want to watch NBA basketball live, you have to watch it over breakfast. Nothing fun ever happened over breakfast. No one ever went, wow, that was a wild and crazy breakfast. You were a madman last breakfast. It doesn't happen. So enjoy your NBA basketball over breakfast, 12,000 kilometers removed from the action. But in the evening, grab a friend, family member, or a lover, or all three. Not as in one person who encapsulates all three of those things, but one, two, three different people or more, and actually be a part of something. The league needs to acquire a little bit more of a sense of humor, I find. Players, you can act like you enjoy playing in the league. You're allowed. That's kosher. That's allowed. You can be from a team outside of the Wildcats and act like the championship matters to you. That is also allowed. I do get that vibe that I feel like the championship means a lot more to the Wildcats than it does to any other team. That's me. Going back to media access, I think most journalists get into the game or the profession for a bit of voyeuristic need to rub shoulders with athletes. Sort of a, I'm friends with the celebrities, and I don't really care for that. You can cover the league fine, if not better, from a distance. Objectivity, I think, is what's most coveted by honest fans. I really do. And new fans. Objectively looking at a subject is never boring, and then also genuine interest. If you are doing something with genuine interest and genuine objectivity, whether it's looking at Wicca or the NBL, it's going to go well. A little inside gossip is always good, but it's nothing compared to balls. To be with the big boys, as Smith puts it, it has to go both ways. Teams, players, and owners have to be prepared to take it. You have to be prepared to take it. And I don't think teams and players at the minute are prepared to take it. And not that they dish it out. They don't. They're very agreeable. But you have to be prepared. If you're going to be one of the big boys, it has to go both ways. You have to slit your wrists and bleed out there and be comfortable with it. Because it's not easy. I'm not saying it is. But ultimately, I think the media should be a conduit for the fans, not the players. So I don't think that increased media access helps in that aim. I really don't. Players give the same answers over and over again. They do. Look at any sports interview. It's a running gag. The most successful episodes of mine have been with Liam Santa Maria, Corey Homicide, and Body Knowledge. The player interviews have rated well. The Bryce Cotton one, for example. Josh Boone. But not as well as those. People want opinions. What that tells me is fans want opinions and analysis. And maybe, and this is probably a bit of ego, but an articulation of their thoughts of the game that they can't quite voice them themselves or need a bit of a nudge to know. They need that articulation about thoughts about the game, teams, players. I think fans just want conversation. I know I do. I just want people to look at a game and say, okay, here's what happened. What did you think? Oh, I thought he was good. I actually thought he didn't play well. Oh, I thought that was good. I thought that was bad. I think that's more important than what did Jesse Wagstaff have for lunch on game day. It's nice to chat to Jesse Wagstaff. And, oh, Jesse, stop it. No, you hang up. But I don't think I don't think fans really want to hear it. Most people who write about the NBL from outside the NBL are so sweet, they'll give you a toothache. There's an honesty and criticism deficit around the NBL. The groveling for access has become a cyclical problem where you write favorable things to get access and to maintain access. You write favorable things and it just keeps going around where you're chasing your own tail because no one's reading it or enjoying it or whatever. Now, I'm going to go a bit off the deep end here because it's the off season and, well, there's nothing else to talk about, really. Here's what I do to boost the NBL. Putting media access to a side. Thanking Ben Malice for his article. Gave me a lot of thought and I appreciate it. But here's what I do to boost the NBL. I wouldn't so much worry about media access at this stage. I think the NBL's okay with its access. Team by team. What I would do is I do a thing called NBL Crunch Time. Now, this is copyrighted of the NBL Pocket Podcast. Everything in entertainment, which sports is about your log line, your elevator pitch. How quickly and how well can you articulate what you want to sell in a heartbeat? A log line is, that quick pitch. You can have the best idea, but can you distill it into a simple, easily understood, and digestible pitch? We could talk for hours about the plot of the movie Die Hard, but the log line reads as simply as this. A New York cop travels to Los Angeles to reconcile with his wife, but learns she's been taken hostage by terrorists in a skyscraper, and he struggles alone to save her. That is one sentence articulating a $140 million idea. Just from that one film, it did spawn sequels, so it's probably close to $1 billion. And it can all come down to a simple log line. Why do I say this? Well, I'll come back to the NBL's logline in a moment, but here's what I do. Here's my approach. You approach one of the commercial networks. Now, right now, people have groaned and going, oh, like they haven't done that in the past. Hear me up. You approach Channel 10. They're the most ailing of the three, 7, 9, 10. You pick a modest TV night for them or maybe something that sits in the middle and you aim to follow the news if possible or a strong lead-in program, something that gets viewers. Most people will persist with watching a station depending on what news they watch. They'll watch 7 News and then just slowly, like a troll, just roll into the next program after program after program, not showing any real interest, but just not showing a greater interest in not getting up to change the channel. Just roll on. So if you have a good lead-in program, you'll do well. The Daily Show with Jon Stewart had Chappelle's Show as its lead-in. It did really well. Once Chappelle's Show left, The Daily Show didn't do quite so well. Your lead-in is almost more important than your program itself. So here's the thing. Find a decent lead-in program. Secondly, you're doing 30 minutes or standard 24 minutes broadcast of basketball. Yes, you heard right. 24 minutes. Not a full broadcast of the game. Well, how's that possible? How do you fit NBL basketball into a very easily digestible 30-minute window, like an episode of Seinfeld or Friends or what have you? Well, you just show the fourth quarter live. People, come with me if you want. You start the telecast with a highlight package of the preceding three quarters, the ups, the downs, the storylines that happened in quarter one, two, and three. And the telecast drops right into the action. Commentators introduce themselves from off screen and you show the full fourth quarter. And obviously, ideally, this works better with an Elam ending so you don't run into overtimes and delays with the end of the game, but putting that to aside. And then when the game is over, you end the broadcast. What happens there is you're packaging the NBL as a reality TV show. And going back to the logline, here's the NBL logline. In a conflict-riddled hardwood battlefield, two teams of five men must score the most points for their city before the clock runs out, and there can be only one winner. Wow. You've described the NBL without even talking about sports, basketball, or anything. You've described it as a reality TV show. That, with a few alterations, that logline could be changed to the block. In a conflict-riddled circumstance, couples of two from each major city in Australia race against the clock to build an armoire or whatever they do on the block. Don't watch it. You see what I mean? You're taking the veil of sports off of it, which might be a good or a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing. You're selling it to a broader audience. Men, women, sports people, non-sports people. Basically, you're saying, okay, this is playing to a finish that you don't know the outcome of. That's reality TV. Married at First Sight. Are they going to stay together? Well, you know they're not, but there's the impression of reality that you don't know the outcome. Well, that's sports, in essence. Turning over the page. Package the NBL as a reality show. Why? Simply because 11 of Australia's top 20 most watched broadcasts in 2019 were reality TV. The other nine were sports. You're getting the best of both worlds, but I think blur the lines between the two. The NBL hasn't existed on free-to-air national TV of any real consequence since 1997 on Channel 10. That's 23 years ago, I think, at this stage. It's fair to say that there is not the national appetite for 2 hours of NBL. NBL basketball in Australia. Is there an appetite for 2 hours of NBA? Maybe. And the Olympics? Sure. But at NBL, are we being honest with ourselves? Is there an appetite for 2 hours once or twice a week in a decent time slot on national free-to-air TV? I don't think so. So you can either say, well, free-to-air TV is never for us. We'll always just go by ticket sales and be a boom and bust league. Well, if you want to do that, good luck to you. Or you just sort of face that fact and come up with something different, which is, well, if we can give, maybe there's not the appetite for 2 hours, but is there the appetite for half an hour? And then you build from there. Oh, hang on, this was quite successful. Maybe let's go to the second half. Let's go the whole game. Other than that, what are you going to do? Keep tapping them on the shoulder saying, hey, would you broadcast our 2 hour long length of games when people don't want it? I'm yet to hear another an idea. But this is all a long story short. I enjoyed that article from Ben Malice. It's where we're at. I disagreed with some, agreed with parts, enjoyed thinking about it, and I'll have to reach out to Ben and maybe even get him on sometime. P.S. NBL Crunch Time is a copyrighted idea of the NBL Pocket Podcast, namely me. You want to use the idea, you got to pay me a lot. A lot of money. Pardon me. All right. This is exciting. WNBL is starting up, and I encourage everyone to watch it. It's Thursday night, I believe. Out of a hub in Queensland,
Southside Flyers have got pretty much the entire Opals team. But I want to talk about Lynn Cambage, in Playboy from September. Hopefully people have seen this. It's been out for a while. The photos are sexy and tasteful. I thought she looked great. She's got this great body with a very feminine, with a few feminine intriguing tattoos dotted around her body. Some are in places that draw the eye to the major tourist attractions of the female form. I really dug it. I thought, I don't know what impact she personally had on her outfit, her makeup, and how it was staged, lit, and shot. But whoever did it was really, really tasteful and really, really sexy and really well done. She was asked 20 questions. And you can actually, I think this article is pinned to her Twitter account, and you can read it for free. I haven't bought a copy of Playboy. I actually went into my local newsagent. I tried to get a copy. He called me a pervert and I ran out. No, he didn't have it. The copy of this particular issue, or maybe it had passed me by. But anyway, I will sort of quickly paraphrase the questions and her answers as best I can. She was asked about, Cambage was asked about her plan for the last year of her 20s. She's 29 this year. Cambage replied, quote, an Olympic gold medal and a WNBA championship. But God's plan was a little bit different this year. My follow-up question would be, which God is that, and what was his or her plan for you? That was just my question for it. When talking about doing the ESPN, the body issue, which is where she posed with her back to the camera, exposed buttocks, posed nude, her reply was, nudity has never really been a sexual thing for me. I'm proud of my 6'8" body and everything it can do. I thought that was a good answer. As I said, I thought that was an intriguing concept. Was the body issue non-sexual and the Playboy issue sexual? The body issue is very much about the moving human form, whereas the Playboy one was sexual. So I would love to ask her about the differentiation between the two. The spread was certainly more sexual or provocative in that Playboy photo shoot. Being teased for her height, this is where this article took a dark turn. Cambage replied, Australia is a very whitewashed country. Cambage here is talking about talking with a friend in the United States. We talked about how people are trying to buy the bodies we grew up being made to hate. I thought that was a really good line. She goes on furthermore, we would do everything to shrink ourselves and make us more white. It wasn't until I moved to America that I started to really embrace my body and my skin color and who I really am. I'd love to ask her, what was it about America that did that? When asked about embracing sexuality as a sportswoman, quote, all society wants for me is to sit down, shut up, go to training and play my sport. And I would challenge Liz Cambage on this one here. Is the society putting on that pressure or the sport itself? Does being good at sports require a masculine or stereotypically masculine complex? Sport is unfeeling, unfair, win, lose, little gray area, if any. It has these unromantic values. You know, and that's just the way it is. So I would ask, is it the sport or the people watching it? She was asked about her activism and being a fighter. Quote, was raised white by my mum and my nana in a very whitewashed country. Again, repeating that. I've been bullied and teased ever since I can remember and I've always been an easy target. So I'm resilient to it. It's the second mention of Australia being whitewashed, which, you know, not that it shocks me. It's a sad fact. I have many questions here. Bullied by boys and girls? Any group in particular? What is Cambage's definition of bullying? What's the line between playful ribbing and bullying? I think we can all agree that there is that line of, you know, you make fun of each other of your friends, but what is the line for her anyway specifically? And can you cite specific examples? They'd be the questions I'd ask her stemming from that. Quote, this is a really interesting bit as well on the NBA overshadowing the WNBA. Quote, what's the point of being happy with what you have when it's not enough? We need to keep pushing for change. We need more diversity. We need to be making more money. You shouldn't stop and be happy with what you have. That's how people get lazy. To have a platform like we do and do nothing is a crime in itself. This is a question of ambition versus contentment and greed, in essence. Is the WNBA to NBA pay scale a diversity and political issue or simply an economic one? The average WNBA wage is $116,000. That's via CNBC. So I don't know how accurate that is, but that CNBC is pretty reliable, I would have thought. And then the thought of the political platform as an obligation in sports. I was actually troubled by that line a little bit. Being apolitical is not a crime. Can a sports person remain apolitical or uninterested in politics in 2020 and beyond? Can they do their job and keep religion and politics for their home? If it is a crime to have a platform and not do something with it, it would appear as though Cambridge feels the opposite. I'd love to ask her about that. My overarching question from the article, which everyone I stressed to you should go and read, and you can find it on Liz Cambridge's Twitter account. Overarching questions: how do we combat whitewashing in Australia? When and where is it most prevalent? Can the ledger be levelled? They are the major overarching questions I have from that article. I believe that's everything. From Corey Homicide to Will Weaver to Liz Cambage to everything else in between. The long NBL off-season continues. Looks like the season is drawing closer and closer, so fingers crossed on that. In the meantime, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Find me on Twitter at NBL Pocket Pod, Facebook, Instagram. There's even a phone line on the Twitter account if you want to give me a ring and give me your thoughts. I would love to hear it. Maybe even put you on the pod. Booktopia, if you're in the buying a book, if you're in the mood to buy a book, do it from there. I get a few quid. That'd be nice. And see you in the future. Ciao.